Hello everyone, this is the 22nd episode of the Angel's Wing Weekend Chat with June, Espresso, Casper and Rubble. And we're here today to chat about, again, AI-generated art, because it's just such an innovative tool. On the show we have today Charles and Wonder. So before I start introducing our speakers, Casper, do you mind telling our audience the backstory of the Angel's Wing?
Yeah, sure. My pleasure. So we are the Angels Wing, founded by friends who met through our beloved Meta Angels project. As you can see from our pinned tweet, we have grown very nicely from a very humble gallery of art to a multi-portal gallery. And all this is founded on the basis of us as friends coming together, showcasing beautiful independent artist art. And we do it through our virtual gallery. But on top of that, we have a very cozy community on Discord who helps give feedback on your art if you're an artist. And we talk about everything under the sun, including the sun. We have a recent collection from our dear friend Hal, who released her collection of solar photography. But we also talk about other things like NFTs, of course, crypto. But in general, this is a very supportive group of collectors and artists alike. I'm also very glad to say that we have regular Twitter spaces, and this is number 22. Wow, it's crazy. And on these spaces, we would showcase art. We'll also chat about very interesting topics, on-trend topics like today, generative AI art, and we're very glad to have our esteemed guests with us today. And of course, the easiest way to get in touch with us is just to DM us and join us. We do not charge any fees. We just ask for, we would appreciate any of your art donations or crypto if you do find our help useful in gaining visibility for your talented work. So without further ado, I'll hand it back to Yun. Thanks, Yun.
Thank you, Casper. So I would like to invite Charles first to speak. I'm actually really glad that Charles made it today because we had some technical issue last time. Charles, do you prefer people calling you and you pronounce your name the French way, or the English way? Just wondering.
So, hi, everyone. So, again, I apologize for last time. I had no clue we needed the Twitter app to participate in spaces. So, a bit of a mistake on my end last time. Charles, in the American way, is just fine with me.
You're actually a physician, and I wondered how a physician actually got into the NFT space. Tell us a bit about your backstory.
So I'm not fully a physician right now. In France, when you finish your residency, your medical school, you become a resident, but you're not a full doctor like in the US. So it's in the middle right now. So I was in the cryptocurrency space like since 2016. So I saw the early Bitcoin rallies. I saw Ethereum at 40 cents or something like that. Like, it was in the middle of my medical study, so I didn't have much time to follow everything that was happening. So I missed out on the CryptoPunks. I missed out on the CryptoKitties and stuff like that. And I eventually rediscovered the NFTs back in like June from last year, June 2021, when it was like all about the Bored Apes and stuff like that. I started minting NFTs for another particular reason, because I was preparing my thesis. And while I was preparing my thesis, which was about AI applications to healthcare, I stumbled upon and their applications for radiology. And then I read about GANs and then realized, oh, you can actually make art with GANs, typically with a VQ GAN plus clip. And so I'm an artist like ever since I was a kid. I've always painted, but I always felt like my technical skills were kind of lacking for what I wanted to express. So I figured that was a great tool to maybe allow me to express and push my ideas further. So I tried with a VQ GAN plus clip. And then I figured I like the outputs. I really like what it looked like. And there's this NFT stuff going on. So maybe I should try to mint one as an NFT and see how it goes. I minted the first one and then sold like in a couple days. Then I made another one and another one. And it picked up progressively like that until, like, here I am.
Wow, that's amazing that you got into the field actually through your profession or what you learned through it.
It's a mix of everything.
So actually, I remember that when I met you last year, you've been creating these, what I really like, these fused danzas.
Yeah, exactly.
And these were also made with GANs, right? Or how did you create these?
Well, it was more like a style transfer. But yeah, it's essentially what got me maybe noticed in the AI space. I would just pick like multiple fidanzas. I would mix them together to create new fidanzas. And there was like this huge discussion whether it was legal or not, if it was like infringing IP rights or something like that. But before doing this, I saw Tyler Hobbs, the artist who made the fidanzas, discussing in the Discord channel that he was totally okay for derivative work from his fidanzas. So I had the green light to do this. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it because it was essentially taking one or two pieces and mixing them together. It's not like how diffusion models or VQ GAN plus clip actually works. So it was a totally different topic. So yeah, those are like your fusion fidanzas, like I like to call them, picked up quite progressively and opened me quite some doors. So from this, I got the attention from some French NFT collectors. So that led me to exhibit my art. So that was another collection. It was a surprise by AI. I managed to exhibit like one piece of this collection in the Mocha Gallery, which was founded by a prominent French NFT collector. So it was a physical exhibit like in the middle of Paris with like hundreds of people at this exhibit. Most of them had no idea what an NFT was, so I had a lot of, like, the opportunity to chat with like 70, 80-year-olds, explain to them what was AI art, what was NFTs, and I was quite surprised to have, they were all very interested in the topic, and I didn't have to receive any negative feedback like I would have expected. After that, I got the opportunity to expose an exhibit in another gallery. It's IHAM Gallery in Paris. And then right after that, like probably a couple weeks after that, there was the first French physical NFT auction, because previously it was totally forbidden to do so, taking place in Paris too. And I sold another NFT in a physical format for the first time. So this was a big one. And then like probably a month ago, I had the opportunity to sell another one in a physical auction at the same auction gallery. So that was pretty cool. And with AI, French AR artist friends, we wanted to set up like the first French AI NFT gallery in France. So we did this. We contacted a gallery. It's called the Japo Gallery in Nice, France. And we set up this gallery for a full month. And so we're pretty proud to have launched this. So yeah, there was a lot going on this year.
Wow. So congratulations on all these great accomplishments.
Thank you.
So when I look at your work, you basically worked on a particular style for a time before you switched to another one, which is really nice. So the Surprised by AI collection was basically like abstract AI landscape pieces, if you can say that.
Yeah.
And, but later on this year, you switched your style again completely, like what we can see in your pinned tweet. So I was wondering, what is the inspiration behind this, or what motivates you to change the style, and also what motivates you, what tools to choose actually? Maybe you can also tell us a bit about tools you're actually using.
So yeah, to answer the first question, what leads me to change styles is not that I want, is that I actually need to do so, because I'm a very curious guy. And I cannot stay put doing just doing something specific for a long period of time. So I set up my Surprised by AI collection. It lasted for a couple months, and I had this need to do something different. Then I set up another collection with another style. I tried animating dragons, a bunch of other stuff, because I had the need to explore all the possibilities that AI allowed me to explore. These other possibilities came with new AI models, because with the VQ GAN plus clip, it was very hard to have a good composition, good perspective, good lighting with your outputs. Like, you were pretty lucky if you had a good output with the VQ Gen Plus clip. Then came in the diffusion models, probably like Disco Diffusion. But then like very quickly, Midjourney came out, then DALL-E, and then Stable Diffusion. And now I use essentially all these models to make my art right now. Yeah, since they allow you to explore more easily different styles, well, many different styles, I figured let's try it out and see what I can do and what I like. So I'm a lot into philosophy, reading about Stoic philosophers. So all this ancient Greece, ancient Rome, for example, art really drives me. There's a lot of, my brain just goes all over the place. So my art goes all over the place. My brain does. That's probably the best explanation I can give.
Oh, it's great. Would you mind explain a bit the term diffusion model?
The diffusion model, essentially, VQ Gen Plus clip is essentially you give an instruction to the AI and the AI is going to create an image and then compare it to another image to see if it's comparable and try to fine-tune it to match the description. What a diffusion model is essentially, it comes from noise and then tries to create an image starting with this noise. It's quite difficult to explain. And essentially, there's the prompt you're going to type is a function that is going to allow the noise to evolve into an image. For this space, I actually retweeted like the full explanation of how a diffusion model actually works because it's way too difficult for me to explain it correctly. So if you guys really want to know exactly how it works, you just need to check out on my profile. It's like probably like the second last tweet that I retweeted, and it's like a 15 post thread and goes in detail on how it works. It's way better explained than I could do.
Yeah, thanks. I just pinned the tweet.
Oh, thank you. Do you actually do post-processing of your pieces?
Yeah, I do.
Your piece went through all these different tools?
It depends. For some, it just depends. For example, for the dragons I have on Foundation, I use another post-processing tool to animate these dragons, and I'm pretty proud of the results. For example, the piece that I posted for Claire's AI contest, I used Adobe After Effects to superpose different DALL-E in painting levels to make a video. I don't know if you guys have seen it or not. Essentially what I did was I used like probably 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different steps of DALL-E painting for this piece. And then I edited them with the Adobe After Effects to de-zoom to give like a wider range. And I'm pretty proud of the result for this piece. But for the other pieces, I don't use much post-processing because I feel like maybe like most of them fit the vision I had previously, so I didn't actually need it. But when I actually feel I need a post-processing, I just use it. So it just depends.
Thank you. What are the images that you actually see when you try to create these text prompts? Or what drives the images behind, or what drives the imagination basically behind these pieces? Like the ideas or what? How do you decide what to create?
It depends again. Sometimes it's just me stumbling like a piece of art from, I don't know, like from a journal or something like that. I was reading a book I'm reading. I'm seeing a piece of art like in a museum and I figured I actually like this style. I would like to see how I could impersonate this style, how I can add my little twist to it. So I tried it out. For example, like I said, I love reading about Greek and Roman philosophy. So this has really inspired me for a couple pieces I've put out on my profile like a couple days ago, where it's really in this antique Roman style mixed with a bit of Renaissance. And I just wanted to picture what I had in mind when I was reading these philosophers. So that was, for example, the inspiration I got. Then, for example, like the latest collection I put out on Object Today, I was mainly inspired by, how to say, like I've always loved Japan always inspired me culturally, artistically, and I wanted to try a little twist with the classical Japanese art with a more, how would I say, a more modern twist with maybe a cyberpunk style essentially, and see if I could put it out. and it actually worked pretty nicely. I was quite proud of myself. It's most of my work is essentially me having ideas, seeing like personal challenges. Can I actually do it? Can I achieve this vision I have? And then I try it out. That's what drives me essentially, personal challenges.
Thank you. That's very interesting. Do we have questions from our co-hosts? Kasper, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, Charles. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, you're welcome.
My question is more related to the gallery that you start, or the galleries that you started. I'm really amazed by this development. I think it's possibly because in Europe, the art scene is more developed, and that's why it seems like display and exhibitions of NFTs seem to be a bit more advanced. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm based in Asia, so I perhaps don't see it as much where I am. But actually, my question with that backdrop is, you mentioned you explained to a 70-year-old about NFT art. How did they take it? Especially something that I'm not sure if they even understand fully how the computer works, much less so how a computer generates AI art. It's towards my understanding of how is NFT as acceptance in your part of Europe.
Again, it really depends. When I was talking to these a couple of 70, 80-year-olds, I explained to them what NFTs were, what AI was, and maybe there is very likely they didn't understand a word I said. It's pretty likely. But they were, I think at least they understood that it was actually a computer that made the piece of art they were watching or looking at. And this didn't upset them one bit. Like, they very liked the concept of a machine making art. And that's what surprised me, because I thought it was like probably like the generation that would be the most opposed to these kinds of technological advances, but they were not. And on the contrary, what I see is the most opposition to AI art tends to come from the younger generation, I think, of artists. And I guess you guys must have seen the whole debate around whether AI art is actually art, whether AI art is infringing on IP rights, whether AI art is a stealing from an artist, etc. And this tends to come from younger people. The older generation either embraces it quite easily or just doesn't know it exists at all. But yeah. It's a very complicated subject because it both intertwines art and politics, I think. And it's a very touchy subject.
Yeah, thanks for the answer. We are all particularly interested because obviously for us, our experience is that even as a gallery, when we display art, when you try to bring artists from the traditional, the audience is very different from the audience who appreciates NFT. So that answer was very insightful and definitely something for us to think about. Thanks, Charles.
And I would like to add one thing. During my last physical NFT auction I was attending, there was actually a woman between 70 and 80 years old who was actually bidding on some NFTs. So it's something the older generation seems to be open to. So
that's great. That's great to hear.
You had a question too?
Yeah. First of all, really inspiring to hear about all of these different tools and styles that you're exploring. And my question is related to the tools, because it's often been mentioned that AI art struggles with making realistic people and faces. And I see in your latest object collection that you have these kind of topics. And
yeah.
Have you done anything in particular to achieve that kind of a photorealistic look?
Many models are trained not to replicate a good human face. Like DALL-E, actually at the beginning, tried to make the faces unrecognizable. He's better at making faces, that's for sure. But it still very frequently distorts the faces. So many of your outputs are just going to be trash. The little secret I had was to ask to put a mask on the faces. And DALL-E and Stable Diffusion are very good at making masks. And when you do masks, the whole portrait is very realistic. There's like essentially no distortion, and you still have the you still allow yourself to enable your vision without the restrictions of the model. Like, it's a little, yeah, essentially. It's a little cheat code.
That's a great tip. And I do see they have masks in NFT. So yeah, that's a really good tip. And also probably this relates to the discussion around AI art replicating the inputs, because I have to imagine that when training a model like this, the OpenAI and the other organizations really want to avoid a true replication. Like you can see exactly the person, the face that was used as input.
Yeah, that's a very good question. Because if you manage to replicate the exact piece, that would be actually IP rights infringement, because that's how the law works. But Imad, the one who's behind the Stable Diffusion, explained that essentially you could potentially have the exact piece that comes out of the model, but they actually encoded, they twist a bit the code for it not to happen at all. So it's not possible for when you use the Stable Diffusion to produce the exact same output that is exactly similar to an existing painting or drawing, etc. Yeah. So you're pretty much safe in that aspect when using either Stable Diffusion or DALL-E.
That's good to know. Thanks. And another question, which is more related to the tech. So I see that you have some works on Foundation and some work over on Tezos. Any reasoning behind selecting blockchain and marketplace? Well, and where do you prefer to mint?
There are multiple reasons behind this. First is to expand my collector base, because some people collect from OpenSea, some collect from Object, and some collect from Foundation mostly. So if I only stayed on OpenSea, I would miss out on a lot of different potential collectors and new collectors. So that was the first reason. The second reason is that OpenSea is essentially a lazy minting website. So I was discussing with this collector at the Mocha Gallery, who told me that if you're not willing to pay gas to mint your NFT, why do you think people would be willing to pay to actually own the piece? Which means that if you're not willing to pay the gas, you don't believe in yourself enough. So that was like this whole mind that totally changed my view. So I decided to post a few on the Foundation to prove that I actually believed in myself. So that was the first part, to expand my base, to change my view about myself. And the second part, when I started, for example, to post on Object, was for multiple reasons. So the first reason was to still expand my collector base, because some people just collected on Tezos. So that was one. Second, for the gas, because yeah, maybe it's important to show you're able to believe in yourself by paying $100 worth of gas, like what it was a couple months ago. But it's not very like something I like, because I like making art to have fun. So if I spend like $100, $200, $300 to mint some NFTs, I expect to be able to sell them so that I'm not losing money, actually, essentially. And that would put some pressure upon me in a sense, I need to sell them. And I didn't want this kind of pressure anymore. So since the gas was way lower and essentially non-existent on Tezos, I basically decided to start minting there. And there's also this whole environmental aspect of Tezos that maybe like Ethereum will attack like in September with the merge, but Tezos is way cleaner than Ethereum too when minting NFTs. So there's plenty of reasons for which I chose these different marketplaces. I hope I answered your question correctly.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. And yeah, totally agree with what you were saying. And also, it's a good point that it's nice to have kind of some kind of lower limit on what to mint. If you think it's worth paying the gas to mint it, then probably it's worth to make an NFT.
Because, oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, because also one of the criticisms of AI art is that it can output like millions of images. And if there's no cost.
Yes.
With that, then we're kind of flooding the market. But yeah, I think really this AI art revolution is all about curating outputs and finding good outputs that actually resonate. And then
for sure. There's no doubt about this. Like, for example, for one piece that I would actually mint, there's probably like 100 left on the side I did, just decided not to show the public. It's very hard to decide between which and which, because when you first look at them, they're all just great. But when you take a step back, and what I like to do is just print out like at the most outputs you can with a single prompt and see what you like. Then you take the ones you like, you put them in a folder and you sleep on it. You come the day later, you open that folder and you take another look at it. And most of the time when you do that, you're like, I thought these were great, but now that I look at them, like probably 90% are still trash. So you've end up like discarding them progressively and progressively until you stick to the ones that actually speak to you and aren't just good colors, good composition, etc. It needs like this magical touch that just speaks to you. And yeah, it's essentially the process I go through, just waiting for me to get bored of the outputs to weed out the actually good ones. So that's how I do. That's my creation process.
Yeah, thank you, Charles, for sharing your thoughts. Very interesting, inspiring to listen to your story. So if we don't have further questions, to move on to Wonder as our next speaker. Hi, Wonder.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's so great to talk to you finally on Spaces. So would you mind to introduce yourself and tell us a bit about how you started as an NFT artist last year?
Yeah, my name's Wonder, Jessica, and I started last April in the NFT space. March of last year, I was going through another difficult time. I have some mental health issues like depression, anxiety, and identity disorder. And a therapist asked me to start art therapy. And so I did, and I remembered I was an artist again because I did a lot of art when I was young. And then I went into graphic design, web design field, and been working in corporate content for the last 15 years. But I forgot that I like to do it for myself. And so I started diving back into my own personal art. And digital art has always been really my medium where I would feel most comfortable. I would used to say I can't draw a straight line, but I can do it in Photoshop. And so I started creating art and I showed it to a few friends and they were like, is that an NFT? NFT, and I was like, what's an NFT? And then I joined in April and quickly just found a community. And I spent the last year really, a lot of my work last year is really me kind of processing and coming to terms with having dissociative identity disorder and then really working on that last year. And that's how I came in the NFT space. And then this year in February, I also quit my job so I could work in Web3 full time because I thought this is where I could bring my art together as well as my other skills and really do what I've always wanted to do, which is be an artist. And corporate content kills my soul. If you've ever had to design for other people, that can be really soul sucking.
Yeah, thank you for sharing this brief and vulnerable story about yourself. And I'm happy that you found this helpful for dealing with these mental health issues. So you actually started, if I remember correctly, creating these collections around, can I say, negative self-talk? Or, I mean, it's basically a collection about how to deal with negative self-talk, if I describe this correctly. And you created lots of positive affirmations pieces, I would say, surrounding the theme of self-love and self-acceptance, right?
Yes. Yeah. And that one is called Real Self Talk Collection. And part of that is it's what I call the Wonder Mundo phase. So a bit of my story too is when I was going through that last year, I was definitely in denial, like this isn't true. And so I challenged myself and I read somebody, it said, how do you prove it to yourself? And I said, okay, maybe I do have parts. If I really do, if there are parts of me in there, do something only I would know. Don't prove it to me. And so one day I was coloring with my son. And I finished coloring and I turned the sheet over and I just started drawing lines. And then all of a sudden those lines like turned into a face. And that's when I remembered everything, like all my memories came back. And that's the Wonder Mundo face. And so that is what that Real Self-Talk Collection is. And it is positive affirmation, things like you're awesome, I love you, because part of what my healing journey has been last year is self-love. Like as cheesy and cliche as it might sound, it's really where it helped me get from not liking myself to liking myself and eventually loving myself. And that was a real personal look at that and something where each one of those had a message that I was working on internalizing myself, because it's one thing to hear it from other people and somebody could say it to me, but I wouldn't believe it. And so it took that internal work to be able to get there. And each one of those pieces has a saying on the forehead. And then there's a little thing that says repeat 3 times daily, because that's what I found myself doing as well, even when I didn't feel like it. And so that was me sharing a part of that to really, for one, put it out there, but also it took me a long time to realize that it's not normal to have that negative self-talk and to unlearn that. And that was a process for me to do that.
Yeah, thank you. So I actually really liked your self-talk collection. And it takes a lot of like also courage to be vulnerable in a public space and talk about your inner struggles. And I think a lot of people have this, but they just probably just keep them for themselves, I think. Yeah, so it's, I think it's very, yeah, courageous of you to do that. And I think it probably also helped a lot of people. I particularly like the part when you're on your pieces, when you wrote this repeated 3 times daily. that's like a nice touch. So this year, actually, you started to create also AI art or AI generated art. So why did you decide to make this move? And do you find that these AI tools helps you more to express yourself artistically in a better way? Or tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so I started with AI art mainly with Midjourney, and I decided to try it at first just because I have a lot of friends that were trying it, and I thought I'll look at it too. And then I quickly fell down a rabbit hole, so to speak, and really was finding my way. Like I mentioned before, like digital art has always been my medium. I'm not the greatest illustrator, and there's some things that I see in my head that I just can't get out. And it's part of, I think, having the disorder that I do have. There's parts of me that are better at drawing with Procreate, and there's other parts of me that are more verbal, or they write that. So once I discovered that I could use AI to create what I see in my head, but I couldn't get out, that's where I really dove in. And when I quit my job, my plan was to start studying creative coding or AI art, or maybe learn to take a drawing class, because I was really in my mind that I had to get these ideas out. But instead of a drawing class or a creative coding, I decided to dive into AI art. So that's why I decided to. And I do find it really does help me get my ideas out. And it also, it's the curation process as well. I think that, like Charles mentioned, it's a lot of that, like where it seems very simple. Some people, you put a few prompts in, but I like to challenge it in a sense where my first collection with Midjourney, I know, did not look like your typical Midjourney work. It looked very different in a sense. And that was the first one. And then even once I started diving into DALL-E, like you see the image I have is my PFP that is made with DALL-E, and even surprising myself in that, where I can get that kind of output of visualizing what I want to see. I could never have done that, honestly, on my own, unless I was doing a collage work or I spent time tracing something with Photoshop. And just the ability to start prototyping, getting my vision out, was why I just fell in love with AI. And also being able to use all those different like skill sets, or there's parts of me that are more visual, parts of me that are more verbal, and bringing all those together with AI is where I really am shining. Like I feel almost like I found a home with AI, and that feels almost weird to say, but it's really where I can express myself. It's just a tool for me. Like, it's not AI, it's a tool that I use to get my idea out.
So your Alice in Wonderland is what you're referring
yeah.
to. Did you say this has been created with Midjourney? Or with DALL-E?
So there's the Alice in Trashland was created with Midjourney, which was, but my new Alice collection is DALL-E.
It's the one on Object, or because you have so many collections.
Yeah, I do. The Alice collection. So there's Alice in Trashland, that one in Midjourney. But I have a new one called Alice Acid and Glitches, also on Object. Okay. That one is DALL-E. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, because I was wondering about that, because you mentioned that before. You had a collection that doesn't look like the typical Midjourney style. And if I look at the Alice Acid and Glitches collection, is very different from Midjourney, actually. You also have the Basurita collection on OpenSea. So do you want to tell us a bit about the background, maybe what inspired you to create this, the topic, and how you choose about the color palette and everything?
Yeah, and actually the Basurita was actually my first AI collection, and one of my first cross-chain collections too. There's 55 on Object and then 55 on Ethereum. And that is, I chose that because, one, I'm a trash artist, or I'm with that community. That's really the community that I fell into and embraced me when I joined the NFT group. And it's not so much about trash art. Your art looks like trash. It's about the ethos of this is art because I say it's art. You can't decide what's art. And I think that's more of the ethos of what trash art is. And there's different kinds. You can put a trash can, but I'm also first generation Mexican American, and I didn't speak English until I was 5. And I've been really reconnecting a lot with my roots too, as well. And so I wanted to create a trash art collection with AI. And the way it happened was the prompt for that one, because I know I share my prompts as well, was like Wonder Mundo, bold and bright colors, trash, glitchy, and trash Mexican, trash and Mexican stuff all over. And I chose that for a few different reasons. One is, even my work prior to AI is full of bold and bright colors. I always use those. And I really wanted to be able to, like, when you put Wonder Mundo into a prompt, it comes out with some fun stuff. And so I want to take that a step further. And I also love to do glitch art. So I was trying to combine all my stuff into one. And then I threw in the Mexican stuff just to see what would happen. And what I found was interesting, because when you throw in something like just Mexican stuff, you're going to get outputs that are very stereotypical. And so what I enjoyed also was really playing with AI. And I felt, because I do have that cultural background, I was able to push it and figure out when not to push it and when to take a step back. For example, there are some things that when I input that were like I would put Mexican, and then it puts a sombrero on it. And that's not really what I want. I'm looking for the essence of it. But I realized that part of AI is we are doing a lot of training with it. And I started down that path because I thought it was really fun to see, if I do this thing, it's going to do this, and what the outputs look like, and having to go through thousands of images to be like, that's not the one, that is too stereotypical. But then there were things that would come out of that piece that were very colorful. And so I think what I found with Midjourney was, when I put in Mexican stuff, it was really taking the pictures of Mexico in a sense. So you see a lot of like concrete, you see a lot of bright colors with like walls and concrete. And if you've ever been to Mexico, there's a lot of stuff like that too. There's everything seems to be made out of concrete. And I grew up on the border, so it was really trying to create those little pieces of stuff that felt like home for me. And I will say that I wasn't expecting that output in it. As I went through the iterations, that's where it landed. And then use that same process. Once I got to a certain spot, I just kept making several iterations and going through the like thousands of images to curate the collection that I wanted.
Yeah, thank you for sharing this very interesting story about this collection. And then why did you switch then to this glitch style on object later on when you started using DALL-E? Because it's just a very different type of style.
Yeah, so as far as like the styles, I like part of, I guess, also being a trash artist, or just in general, is like, I can't feel like I box myself in. And so I'm always going to explore different styles. But also, I didn't go to art school. I don't know a lot, as much as I probably should, about art history. So sometimes I usually don't put in like in the style of this or that. And the outputs that I get are really words that I connect with, and then that comes out. And so the way that I got to the Alice collection, the new one, the glitches one, was part of what I also have been doing with DALL-E is my PFP is me trying to imagine a Wonder Mundo version of myself, or different versions of myself, and what they might look like in my inner world. And so I really liked that style of how it was coming out with the different hues. And so this was so the Alice collection came where I did the same thing that I did before with Midjourney, where I just took out Wonder Mundo and I replaced it with Alice in Wonderland. And then I started getting those outputs. And then I used the same process that I think Charles mentioned, where I will use the same prompt and I will do thousands of outputs, and then I'll curate that until I get bored. Honestly, it's a really fun process to be like, oh, let's see what comes out. And that's how I got there. And Alice is something like, my name is Wonder Mundo because I love Alice in Wonderland and I'm Mexican. And so Alice has been a theme throughout all of my NFT work. And Wonder Mundo is kind of a stand-in. You see a Wonder Mundo hidden in a lot of my work. And so I would say it's almost like an accidental style with the Alice and Acid and Glitches collection that I landed on. But I love it. And so that's where I'm going. There's the part that I'm feeling like at home with DALL-E with that collection is I'm able to bring together, I feel like, my few different styles, where I love collage work. I've done collage. I do glitch art. I do trash art. And I feel like that brings it together in a sense. And so that's where I landed on that.
Thank you. I was actually about to ask you what the story behind your name Wundermunde is, but you just explained it. So I was wondering, as Charles already mentioned, that like most of the output is not really useful. So what do you say is a percentage of outputs that you find useful in the end from all these thousands of outputs that you have to generate to find the ones that you liked in the end?
I don't know what the percentage would be. I think it's a lot. I would say it's probably like 80-20 now, but I will say my first AI collection, I minted a lot of them. And if I go back now, I probably wouldn't have picked some of those because I was still learning. I think I didn't do as much curation. I was just like, oh, this is awesome. This is so cool. This looks so cool. But then as I started working with AI more, I would say like the new collection that I have now that I'm working on for an on object, I'm limiting to 25. Some of the first two AI collections I have are 100 pieces. And so I left myself more room there because it was really hard for me to, I think it was about, I had 500 or 1,000 images on those and I got it down to 100. But the Alice collection is the first one that is really big where I think I'm at 1,500 outputs now and I'm only going to pick 25 and I'm dropping 5 at a time. It's taking me longer though because as I go through it and I'm curating them, I'm trying to tell the story and it's very specific. And so I can't do math very well off the top of my head, but the newest one will be, like I said, I'm at 1,500 outputs and there will be 25. And that doesn't mean that the rest of them are all trash or not good. They're just not part of what I want the feeling for this collection. Yeah, there's sometimes stuff that is never usable, but some of the other stuff is just something that I like it. I just doesn't feel right for the current collection.
Very interesting to hear how your process is. Do we have questions from the co-hosts? Casper, go ahead.
Yeah, I wonder, Jessica, thanks, of course, for joining us. I just have a very simple question. Looking through all your collections, it's beautiful. I also noticed there's a very distinct purple hue to almost all of them. Is this a pure coincidence based on the prompts you've typed in, or it's just something that's very close to your heart?
Good question. It's something that's close to my heart because I used a lot of purple, pink, and bright green hues before. And with this collection, I am also making sure that it has that same hue because that feels right to me. It feels like Wundermundo, where if it didn't have that hue, it might not feel as right to me.
Ah, I see. Okay. Thanks.
Any other questions? Espresso? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've been doing this browsing. I'm curious about this trash art movement that you mentioned. So what was it about that community that drew you in? And I see also a lot of it seems to use some glitchy style or pixelated. Can you maybe elaborate a bit on this for people that are new to it, like me?
Yeah. And so I think what I always say, I think trash art found me. And it's because my first couple of collectors identified themselves as trash artists. And I remember when they collected and they said, this reminds me of another trash artist. And I was like, does that mean like my art is trash? Is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? And then I'm also really good friends. One of my first friends in the space was Empress Trash, who also goes by that name. And what I quickly learned was like, it's not about trash or like it's about the ethos of, it's more of the mentality of I decide what's art. And a lot of the artists who say like they're a trash artist or also identify in that same way, but like the history of it in the NFT space goes back to, I believe, Rob Ness. If you're familiar with Rob Ness, there was some debate early on, and this was 2019 if I recall correctly, there was a big one, Super Rare. He was on Super Rare and a few other artists were on Super Rare, and he was using things like glitch and like photo mosh, and there was a debate whether is that art, and there was really big collectors saying that's not art, they wanted a more refined art. And so what Rob Ness did was take a picture of a trash can on Home Depot and mint that on Super Rare. Later he got banned, although they're all reinstated now, which is funny because it's come full circle. So that's where it started, because somebody said, don't do it. And a lot of the trash artists are like, you can't tell me what to do. I'm going to do what I want. And so now the movement, though, is it's almost in three different parts. You have the art that's like a meme, almost like the trash can, That's a meme itself. And then you have the other side of it is people who are just coming together. There's no one style of trash art. It's really just saying, this is what we're doing. And so recently we also did a test trash event on Object where we all organized and we're like, let's just have a test trash event and get more people together so that we can grow this a bit more, really just help other people understand, like, you decide what's art. And then I think that's the biggest thing about what I say trash art is no one else should be able to tell you what's art. And it's even like with this whole AI debate, a lot of people that are into trash art are AI artists. And so there seems to be some kind of overlap Venn diagram going on there with glitch art too. I think it's because a lot of it is curation and a lot of it is, it goes back to also if you think about like the Dada movement, like you can't tell if I say it's art and in this space, there's so much noise about what's art, how should you price things, what should you do, how big should your collections be, and like the whole thing is you should do whatever the hell you want to do, not what other people should say.
Thanks. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And yeah, that really it reminds me of the old Duchamp days and all of this discussion. I thought we had moved past this. Art is whatever the artist says is art, but apparently not yet.
No, and it's interesting. I saw like Claire Silver recently did like that contest with AI. And even on that thread, I saw there was somebody who said, who showed their process, the way they used AI. They took the AI and then they painted over and did a bunch. And somebody said, oh, that's the right way to do AI. And then I saw other people say, no, actually, if you take a raw output, that is art. And so even within the AI community, there's like almost like another debate on is a raw output considered art. And so like personally I took that as a challenge where I want my raw output to be considered art, and I work towards that where someone will look at it and they're like, wow, and I'm like, yeah, that's raw output and it's art, but you have no idea what I went through to get there. Like I say again, the PFP that I have here is total raw output, and in some circles that's not the right way. And so like now it's like a challenge for me personally, but I even find that interesting where even within the AI community there is like raw versus adding stuff to it.
Yeah, that reminds me that some people also mentioned that photography went through the same thing when it became popular, and the early artists painted over their photos to make it art, and now we're way past that. Everyone agree that any photography piece can be art. So maybe it's just a matter of maturity. This tool is so new, the AI art tools, that it needs to mature. People need to get used to it.
If I may add something.
Yes, go on.
Regarding, like, I think it's a fair comparison to compare photography to AI art, in the sense that the artists, like the painters, the manual artists, are both scared of these technologies. And the argument that comes when people say they are afraid of AI art replacing like classical artists is that photography came in and classical artists still exist. So AI art is not going to replace them. But photography did, in fact, push away many classical painters. Because, for example, when you needed like to do a cover for a book, you would ask for an artist to draw it or paint it or et cetera. But now what you have is you have very often stock photography to do this. So stock like photography progressively erased most drawers, painters from this scene, for example. And I think AI art is progressively going to erase a lot of, how would I say, like artists that aren't masters of their crafts. If you're not able to implement AI into your own craft, then you're probably going to get erased by AI. I think that's my point of view. That's
yeah. And if I
don't...
If I can add to that, I agree with you. I think what you're saying is if you don't, as an artist, learn to embrace AI as a tool and in your workflow, you might get left behind. And I feel the way the parallel for me on this is, and this is age myself, like I started designing websites as a hobby when I was like 15, like in 1997. And I was like, I'm going to be a web designer. And so I think because of that, I've seen the journey. Like I had to use Dreamweaver. I would hard code it in Word. I would code it with like Notepad. And then people would be like, oh, Dreamweaver is just your, you know, and I've gone through these for like everything. And if I had And I definitely went through a period early on, early 2000s, when like you started having different tools come out, like Wix and stuff, like, oh my gosh, what am I, had an existential crisis, what am I going to do? But then I quickly learned when one of my first jobs out of college was doing production work, so like for a digital, for a web online children's clothing store. So I would have to take photos, Photoshop them, do all this stuff. And I had all these macros set up because it was just repetitive. And that's what AI is. And so if it can take the things that are like mundane or more repetitive for me, it frees me up to have more creativity, to be able to create more complex things. And I think because, I don't know, that's me personally, I went through that early on, at least with my professional career, either I embrace these tools and figure out how to make it part of my workflow. So instead of designing some poster, I'll just go to Canva now and get a template because that's easy. And then I can create something cooler because I have the base and I'm not recreating everything from scratch each time. And that's how I feel with AI now. And it's everywhere and it's going to get exponential. And I agree with you. If you don't figure out how to incorporate, that is where that's a danger. But I also think that's the hard part, where if a person isn't willing to look within themselves and do that work, it's easier to just say AI sucks or AI is not art. But I find that the people that were with me back and said, oh, they'll never replace a web designer, there'll never be a system that'll get better than Dreamweaver. No, that's total lie. We got past that and those people are left behind. And I'm seeing that here now, but I think it's going to happen a lot quicker. Like it took 20 years with the web, what I'm talking about here, this is probably going to happen in the next 5 years, I think. And so I agree with you.
Well, we have exactly the same discussion in the medical field. Like, for example, for the AI applications for radiology are doing way better than human radiologists to diagnose. So we don't have this whole discussion about, oh my God, we're fear for our jobs, we're going to be eradicated by AI, we should ban AI aren't doctors, AI didn't go through 10 plus years of medical school like us, so they are not really doctors, they can't really diagnose. We're now having the same conversation we're having with AI when AI is applied to art. I don't know why, essentially, but it's the same discussion. And what radiologists aren't going to do is that they're just going to use the tool in their process, like you just said. The AI is going to maximize the process, make it more efficient. And that's how the way it is going to be. If you're not going to adapt and integrate AI in your daily life, you're going to be left out. So that's just why I just do not understand the whole discourse coming from classical artists as to why AI is just bad and should be banned. I just don't understand it. So maybe if someone could open my eyes, I don't know.
That's probably a bit of fear as well. Like, of course, an artist that has worked for a number of years and built up both a style and a collector base and a way of working, a process, getting that overturned and having to integrate a whole new set of tools and change style maybe to accommodate, that can impose a lot of fear, right?
Oh, for sure. But we have the same issue with, for example, dermatologists, ophthalmologists, radiologists. Most of them are going to see their jobs greatly impacted by this technology. But we don't see them actually complaining and trying to get the AI banned or stuff like that. It's only on the AI art part, art side of the discussion that this happens. And I'm just wondering why.
I think one, I don't know the answer, but I think it's probably also individual to each person. Like, I know I have tweeted before, if you hate AI art, you should look at yourself within yourself and ask yourself why, because there's probably something there. But I think one of the reasons, though, I think is because we still as a society value time. More time equals more value. And we really need to separate productivity from value. And I think that's what I see, because I see a lot of, I spent 10 hours painting this and AI can do it in 1 second. Yeah. And imagine if you could do it in 1 second or 1 minute and you had 9 hours to even create something else. But I think people have to do that work. But I also think it's because fundamentally, like I said, as a society, we still have the amount of hours or hard work tied to what is valuable. And until we separate that out, I think we'll continue to have a lot of these discussions. Because I think I went through that too. Oh, it used to take me hours to design a website. Now I can just go grab something. But it took that for me to click it. But I think that's one of the issues that I see, at least a lot of people feel like they can't keep up. But yeah, you're not going to keep up and you never will. So embrace it. And that's how I see it.
Yeah, I think you're totally right, because unconsciously, I think I'm thinking the same way. Like, for example, I posted a painting I'm working on, I'm currently working on. And what I tweeted was like 30 plus hours in, like in the sense I was proud of having put up all these hours, all these efforts into making this piece. So I think you actually nailed the issue, is that people actually value the time they put into the art they make, and they're not willing to or not prepared to evolve on this through this process. So yeah, I think that's the actual issue. I never thought about it. So thanks for pointing it out.
Yeah, and I think it also comes from, there was a debate early on too around low effort art and like, why does low effort art like it? I took it in that same way, but like, I think what a lot of people don't understand sometimes too is, yeah, something might have taken me 5 minutes, but I've spent 20 years honing some craft, and so that's why I can do it. But again, it really doesn't matter how much time I spent on it. It should just be about the intrinsic value of what I see in the art. And yeah, I think, but it takes a while, I think, to get there. And even personally, I'll struggle with it sometimes, and I have to check myself to be like, it doesn't, because I almost want to be like, I spent 24 hours curating, and I'm like, it doesn't matter how many hours I spent.
Exactly. Yeah. But
yeah, I think
eventually they'll understand. they'll understand. They have to move on.
Yeah, and I just want to add, I think also it's somehow easier, at least as a collector, to value a piece based on the perceived effort that went into it. If a piece is, I have no idea how they managed to make this, or I see that this much must have taken a lot of effort, then somehow it grows in value. And I've also seen on Twitter people in this, when discussing this topic, some people have a very strict stance that the value of art is not related to effort at all. But then I wonder, like, how should we value art instead? Because it's so easy to jump to the value equals effort.
I think you should value art based on what it makes you feel. For example, I collected a piece on an object like a couple weeks ago. It was some generative art piece. And I don't know how much time it actually took the artist to code this piece. I just didn't care. What I saw was that this piece evoked something inside me. I really needed it at this point. So I tried to throw out a bid to the current owner. It was rejected. So I ended up paying way more than I expected to pay for it. But I actually needed it because it just spoke to me. And regardless of the time put to actually make it. So I think this is how art might get considered through the art revolution process, is that it's not the time, the difficulties of the that was put in to create this piece, but what it evokes into the viewer. I think that's the main point.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And somehow it also makes me associate with some of the great traditional art masters have loads of assistants and whole teams building their pieces. And that also breaks the value equals effort.
Oh, for sure.
Piece of it.
Yeah, you could probably compare our art to what Jeff Koons or Murakami do. Jeff Koons has like an army of workers who work to build his vision. And it's exactly what AI art is. You use a model to build your vision. But nobody is saying that Jeff Koons isn't an artist, right? So that's...
Yeah, exactly.
It's essentially the same process.
So usually we stop the space after an hour, but this discussion was just so interesting. And I really loved hearing the different opinions. And yeah, I feel really inspired by the two of you. And I really enjoyed this chat. And it was helpful to understand AI art better and how fascinating these new innovative tools actually are. And that we shouldn't see these tools actually as a threat to traditional art, but rather as enhancement of artistic self-expression, which art is actually in the end about. So... Yeah, so thank you so much, Charles and Wonder, to share your stories and insights with us. It was really great. Probably one of my favorite episodes this time. Yeah, so have a great Sunday, everyone, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. In time.